The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
The change is to that balancing test. The new rule really, the main question in the policy now becomes whether the activity at issue is within the scope of news gathering as defined. So the new policy defines news gathering, and if you're within that news gathering line or on that news gathering side of the line, then process is not available.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, June 5th, 2023. It's been about 6 months since the Attorney General issued new guidelines on compulsory process to members of the press in criminal and national security investigations. And two officials of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, Bruce Brown and Gabe Rotman, wrote a detailed analysis of the document in two parts for Lawfare a couple of weeks ago. Gabe Rotman joined me in the Goat Rodeo studio to go through the document carefully, the long history that led to it, the shifting policies that have gotten more restrictive over the years since the Supreme Court ruled in Brandsburg v. Hayes, the ramp up of leak investigations and reporter subpoenas in the Obama and Trump administrations, and the new policy that creates a red line policy against them under most, but not all, circumstances. We talked about the document. We talked about why the Justice Department has forsworn a historic and upheld authority. We talked about what it means for reporters and criminal investigations going forward. It's the Lawfare Podcast, June 5th. Gabe Rotman on the Justice Department's new guidelines on press subpoenas. So I want to start with some history. This is a issue that has been actively contested since I was a small child. And I associate it originally with the kind of immediate post-Watergate period. When did this first come up, and how long has the press and the Justice Department been fighting over document production requests and testimonial requests, demands to reporters for matters related to their sources?
So it actually predates by a couple of years Watergate. It all came about starting in 1970 under the Nixon administration with the law and order approach. And the then Attorney General John Mitchell issued a number of subpoenas in connection with that general strategy of the Justice Department, one of which was to Earl Caldwell, a reporter for the New York Times, who had fostered significant sourcing within the Black Panther Party. And in response to that subpoena and the significant controversy that arose, Attorney General Mitchell was surprised, at least according to the reporting from the time, at how vigorous the concern over that subpoena was. That subpoena actually was one of the three subpoenas that resulted in the Supreme Court case in Brandsburg that held that there's no general reporter's privilege. But in connection to Caldwell and a few other things, Mitchell announced that he would institute a policy at the Justice Department limiting when and how it can use subpoenas to seek information from reporters and to try and force them to disclose their confidential sources. So it all stems from that that era in 1970. And then over the course of ensuing years, there's been this dynamic where you would have a controversy like Caldwell. The guidelines would get revised. You'd have a number of years go by without any news on it. And then you'd have another controversy. And the Justice Department would, again, look at the guidelines and revise them. And that's happened. It happened in 1980 with a subpoena that sought phone records from Howell Raines and the Atlanta Bureau of the New York Times in a case involving the Klan. And in response to that, the Justice Department revised the guidelines to include telephone toll records. And then most memorably for us probably is in the mid-2010s, there was a subpoena to the Associated Press in the underwear bomber case seeking to identify confidential sources for AP reporters. The subpoena there was quite broad. It covered 20 phone lines used by more than 100 AP reporters. And it was also issued secretly. Because the guidelines, the policy then had a presumption against notifying an affected member of the news media unless the attorney general made an affirmative determination that prior notice wouldn't cause harm. And then after the AP subpoena, shortly after, it came to light that in 2010, a Fox News correspondent, James Rosen, had his email, the actual contents of his email, seized pursuant to a search warrant. And that just added to the controversy and led to several revisions to the guidelines that flipped that presumption against prior notice, and then actually added search warrants to the types of process covered by the guidelines. And then that led to what we learned in 2021, that in the last year of the Trump administration, there had been subpoenas for phone records and email records covering 8 reporters across 3 news outlets that were also issued under that delayed notice procedure. And then we had discussion over revising the guidelines now.
So before we get to the current guidelines, it does seem to me like everybody except the press has a kind of selective outrage about this, you know, that a lot of Republicans were upset at the aggressiveness of the Obama administration in this area. Democrats were upset at the aggressiveness of the Trump administration. Is there any pattern that you can discern about Republican presidents being more aggressive in this area than Democratic presidents or vice versa? Is this a Bill Barr problem or a Loretta Lynch problem? Or is this just a institutional friction between the Justice Department and the press over time?
I think it is emphatically the latter. If you look at the trend lines, there's no partisan sheen that you can discern one way or the other. You know, the Obama administration famously pursued leak investigations at a greater rate than all other presidencies combined. That's the quote that's often given out there, or the statistic that's often given out there, and it happens to be true, but I think the reality is even a little more complex. And, you know, the Trump administration continued with that trend, bringing cases like Reality Winner and Daniel Hale. And I think, as you say, it's just institutional friction. Both sides have jobs to do, and the sense of what those jobs are maybe differs.
All right, so there is this amazing exception to this pattern, and that is Merrick Garland, who comes into office and, basically capitulates to the longstanding demands of the press, whether I don't mean capitulate in a negative sense, but really says the Justice Department, you know, renounces the Justice Department's historic position, which is, you know, one variation or another of we reserve the right to do this, but we're going to do it sparingly with a lot of review. And he puts forward a document, the details of which we will discuss in a moment, but that basically amounts to the general bright line rule is we're not going to do this. And so before we get to the details of that document, I want to talk to you about the psychology of the decision. you know, Merrick Garland, who is the word that everybody uses to describe him all the time, is institutionalist. You know, on this issue, is actually renouncing a historical institutional position of the department. Why?
I wish I could speak to the specific psychology. I don't have insight, you know, into that. But I think it's certainly true, as you say, that that the rule that has been laid down, you know, is in many respects, and we'll talk about the potential edge cases, but is in many respects, you know, as strong as anything that you could think about in this case or in this situation. And I mean, I guess what I would say too is that the rule isn't just there to protect reporters, right? The rule is, I mean, it's there to protect reporters. It's there to protect the democracy enhancing function that public interest journalism brings, particularly when it comes to government transparency. But it's also there to manage headaches for the Justice Department. You know, as I say, the dynamic that you've seen historically is, you know, for whatever reason, you'll see overreach. There'll be public outcry about that overreach. The Justice Department will apologize and will revisit the guidelines in order to try and prevent that from happening again. And that just serves efficiency in government operations.
So I want to try a different angle to try to get you to address the psychology, not the specific psychology, but the institutional psychology question. One possible explanation is the inefficiency of constant revision, and that you look at this and you say, okay, at the end of the day, the total amount of information that we're getting by, you know, by not renouncing this position is vanishingly small, and it causes institutional embarrassment on a serial basis. And so just don't do it. And, you know, we have 1,000 ways of getting information. And by the way, we never finish a leak investigation anyway. So it's not, you know, it's not like we're, you know, giving up a whole lot. But the problem with that argument is that the circumstances in which the Justice Department reserves the right to do these are some of the most, you know, it's not the routine case, right? It's the case where you expect some significant violation of the Espionage Act, or where you, you know, believe that there is a real national security exigency involved in something, you know, in the Rosen case, it involved North Korea, right? So I'm curious why the Justice Department would leave itself basically no exception. And we'll get to the whether there really is no exception in a minute, but it's a pretty bright line rule. And, you know, prosecutors usually don't say, hey, there's a Supreme Court opinion that says we get to do this. We're not going to do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Which is really the historic thing here, right? We're talking about forbearance from powers that the courts have generally said that the Justice Department has. You know, I think it's important to actually talk about the details of the policy in terms of where the door may have been left open, because a lot of this really – the rubber meets the road when we're talking about national security leak investigations, because, you know, the Justice Department has long taken the position, and it hasn't changed that position, and it's important to emphasize that the Espionage Act applies to the receipt, possession and publication of classified information by anybody, reporters included. And, you know, the rule is, you know, as we'll see, the rule expressly covers those elements of the life cycle of national security reporting, possession, receipt, possession and publication. But there's also the sort of gray area that we talk about in terms of the actual pursuit of information. Well, again, we'll talk about that in a second. But no, absolutely. In a lot of ways, it is a historic act of forbearance by the Justice Department. But I'm also not sure that, and again, as we'll talk about, that there are edge cases where, you know, process may still be available, you know, and certainly, again, the Justice Department has not expressly stepped away from the position that the Espionage Act applies to those types of activities.
All right. So let's dive into the document itself. First of all, this was issued last year. You and your co-author analyzed it in Lawfare recently. So there was a bit of a lag for readers who were wondering if they missed a news event. As succinctly as you can, describe the previous policy and describe what the new document changes it to.
Mm-hmm. So the previous policy was a balancing test that would be engaged in by the department, where it would weigh the investigative need against First Amendment interests as it perceived them. And if the balance tipped in favor of those investigative needs, then process would be available. Subpoenas, search warrants, court orders for certain types of electronic metadata. And there were protections in place or checks in place to ensure that this was only being used in extraordinary cases, things like prior notice to an affected member of the news media, high-level approval, most approvals by the attorney general, and then some form of exhaustion. So you had to take all reasonable steps to get the stuff from somebody else. The change is to that balancing test. The new rule, and as we'll discuss this, really the main question in the policy now becomes whether the activity at issue is within the scope of news gathering as defined. So the new policy defines news gathering, and if you're within that news gathering line or on that news gathering side of the line, then process is not available.
So it's a balancing test in which assuming you count as engaged in news gathering, 100% of the weight is on one side.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that makes the definition of news gathering particularly important.
Right. So in a world in which everybody has a podcast and a Twitter feed, that seems to me to be – I don't know if it's a loophole, but it's a question that requires an interpretive exercise. What do we know about who counts as a news gatherer for purposes of this policy?
Yeah. So it's a functional approach, which is good. Whenever, and this is the eternal question, what is news gathering? Who counts as a journalist? It's a functional approach, and it basically says that news gathering is the process by which members of the news media pursue, collect, obtain information for disclosure to the public. And then it has two qualifiers there that are really important for national security leak cases.
Right. So let's hold the two qualifiers for a moment. But does that mean if you're reporting anything newsworthy, you're a news gatherer? Or does that mean if you are engaged in activity that looks a lot like being a reporter? I mean, for example, a citizen standing up in a public town hall and asking a public official a question, that could be a reporter or it could be an angry member of the public, right? But in that moment, they're doing the same thing. And if you're a reporter, you're news gathering at that point because you're asking a public official a question. Would the Justice Department, if it's suspected that that person's phone has, you know, relevant evidence and that person is not a professional member of the media, do we assume that that person, because she was asking a question of a public official in a public location, sort of the way a reporter does, counts as a reporter? Or do we assume that that person is, hey, any citizen can ask a question. That person's asking in a capacity as a citizen. No evidence of news gathering.
So it's a great question. And this is always, you know, there are two questions in the policy, you know, who counts as a member of the news media for the policy to apply at all, you know, and then what is news gathering? On the question of who counts as a member of the news media, the Justice Department, since 2013, after the AP and James Rosen cases, has been issuing annual reports where it describes, you know, in some detail how it applies the guidelines. And if you read those reports, historically, tends to err on the side of caution. And so, you know, even, you know, someone who self-identifies as a journalist who's arrested, for instance, for allegedly accosting a cabinet member during a congressional hearing, the department applied the guidelines nunc pro tunc. They applied them retroactively and sought authorization for the arrest kind of after the fact. And you'll see instances of that happening with some frequency where in an abundance of caution, they'll apply the guidelines to self-described members of the news media and the like. It's unclear how that will play out under the current guidelines. There is a process where if there's a close or novel question about whether someone is a member of the news media, that has to be approved at a higher level. But again, here, because the question is whether you're engaged in news gathering, that threshold question of whether you're a member of the news media is a little bit, I think, less important. And I do suspect that, you know, citizen journalists and, you know, freelancers will be covered by the guidelines.
And then you describe two exceptions for national security purposes. These seem to me to be pivotal in the sense that the policy, it's hard to imagine how it could work without them. So walk us through what these two exceptions are, and then I have some questions about them.
Yeah. So the qualifiers from the definition of news gathering, it basically works in two ways. There's two sections. The first one says that the mere receipt, possession, or publication of government information, including classified information, is within the scope of news gathering. It also importantly says that establishing a means of receiving that information, so for instance, moving to encrypted communications, is also within the scope of news gathering. And then it says that certain broad categories of criminal activity, and then it lists them, but it's not listing specific statutes. It's using, you know, small b burglary, for instance, right? Small t theft, small u unauthorized access to a computer network. It lists those activities and it says these are not news gathering. And the issue that we point out in the pieces in Lawfare is that there are certain federal statutes where if you read them in isolation, the plain text would apply to, for instance, receiving government property. So if you receive, you know, a manila envelope with classified information, that could potentially be a violation not just of the Espionage Act, but Section 641, conversion of government property for your own purpose. And so the potential there is that reporters engaged in what we would consider routine news gathering, the pursuit of information, that you could have an aggressive prosecutor articulate a conspiracy or aiding and abetting or another inchoate criminal theory in those cases.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Could your political views make you the target of cybercrime, identity theft, stalking, or even violence? I used to think this was silly, and then weird things started happening to me. Someone defaced my car. It had Lawfare license plates on it. Somebody delivered weird antique postcards of Guantanamo Bay to my house. You know, weird stuff. The volume of personal data online has tripled between 2019 and 2023, and angry individuals fueled by political polarization can access it all for up to 98% of American citizens. And I was one of them. Lots of people were using my name, my home address, other information about me to try to intimidate me. And I want to say that has dramatically slowed down in recent months. And one of the reasons is Delete Me. As I have said before, there are products here that I read the ads because, you know, that's my job. And there are products here that I read the ads because I really use them and really like them. And Delete Me is one of the Lawfare advertisers that I am most enthusiastic about. And here's why. It finds and removes personal information I don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from all of the largest search databases on the web, and in the process, it helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. And here's the important point. It doesn't just do it once, because the information will get back into the systems. It does it, and then it does it again. So the first time I got one of these reports, and they send regular reports at DeleteMe, you know, there were a whole bunch of systems that I'd come off of. But then each time I get one now, there's still one or two or three that I'm back on the system and DeleteMe has once again deleted me. So sign up and provide DeleteMe with exactly what information you want deleted, and their experts will take it from there. And as I say, they send regular personalized privacy reports showing what info they have found, where they found it, and what they removed. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. When you sign up, they immediately go to work scrubbing all your personal information from data broker platforms. Your personal profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for DeleteMe now at a special discount for Lawfare listeners. Today, get 20% off your DeleteMe plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use the promo code Lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code Lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code Lawfare 20. All right, let's think about this in practice. The qualifications basically say if you committed a crime to obtain the information other than any crime that might be described by mere receipt, that's not covered.
Right. So that's the gray area. It's if the life cycle of the reporting is getting the information or is seeking the information, receiving the information, having the information, and then publishing the information, it's the piece before receipt where there are questions, some uncertainty.
Assuming you didn't burglarize something yourself or hack something yourself, it's pretty clear that once you've done one of those things, you're kind of game on from the Justice Department's point of view, right?
Game on in the sense of the policy applies or doesn't.
It doesn't apply because you're legitimately a subject of the investigation, right? Than yourself, and you know they may reasonably want to prosecute you for, you know, anything from trespassing to burglary to CFAA kind of stuff.
Right. So certainly if you're a reporter and you break into a bank in order to get files for a story, that's not protected. You know, whether it's within the scope of news gathering or not, that would likely be closer novel question. And there would be, you know, there would be some review, but it's pretty clear that the guidelines are not meant to shield reporters from garden variety crimes that are not related to news gathering. The trickier issues are when the underlying act by a journalistic source is itself a crime. So that's Espionage Act, Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, bunch of others. And then you, as part of news gathering, you know, seek information, foster a relationship with that source in order to try and get that information. And then how does that come down under the policy?
And what about if, as Julian Assange apparently did with Chelsea Manning, you sort of encourage the hacking and stealing? You know, you didn't do it yourself. He hasn't, I don't believe, been charged with conspiring to do it. But how much coaxing can you do and still be within the policy?
That's the ultimate question. The example, the hardest example, or one of the hardest examples I can think of, and we mentioned this in the piece, is you're a reporter. There's the Senate torture report, the full torture report, not the executive summary that's still classified. And you say, if you give it to me, I will publish it on the front page tomorrow. That's solicitation, right, of what is on the face of the statute a crime. And it even goes beyond that a little bit in terms of there's almost arguably consideration, right? If you give it to me, I'll publish it. So you're really inducing procuring a crime in that case. And the question is, how would the policy apply?
And you think the answer to that is we don't know at this stage?
We don't know. So there's two things. One is, I mentioned that the definition of news gathering includes that term pursues, the pursuit of information, which suggests that it's not just passive receipt, or at least hopefully would signal to a prosecutor reading the guidelines that it's not just passive receipt. And then there's another process where if there is, and I keep saying close or novel because I'm quoting directly from the guidelines, the policy, if there's a close or novel question about whether something is within the scope of news gathering, it goes up to an assistant attorney general for determination. If there's genuine uncertainty, again, quote unquote, on that question, then it goes up to directly to the attorney general to make that final determination. And so hopefully, at least in those close edge cases, there would be the attorney general himself or herself would put eyes on the issue and make the final determination.
All right. So in practice, let's talk about how different this would be from the prior policy where, you know, the message was don't do this unless you really, really, really have to. And by the way, if you really, really have to, you got to show up in the attorney general's office and have him review it, and it's going to be a real pain in the ass. So functionally, how would the cases decided under the previous policy have looked if you had decided them on the, under this policy?
Yeah. So I think, and we argue as much in the pieces that the Associated Press subpoena, which, and the concern over the Associated Press subpoena was twofold, really. It was one, that it was overbroad, and two, that it was issued in secret, that there wasn't prior notice. And that, unless there was some indication that goes beyond just mere receipt of the information, that if the prosecutor had on hand information that suggested that the reporters had done something more than just get the information, then it likely would be barred under the current policy. Clearly within the scope of news gathering and, again, receipt, possession, and publication of classified information. Likewise, with the 2020 seizures from CNN, New York Times, Washington Post, same kind of argument. One of the trickier questions, we've touched on this already, is the sort of James Rosen scenario, which also can apply now in the context of process that isn't a search warrant, so subpoenas or court orders under the Stored Communications Act. In that case, the concern is that the department would articulate would try and invoke a suspect exception where they would articulate that nominal conspiracy theory or aiding and abetting theory in order to get around the bright line. But in the James Rosen case, the previous guidelines included a provision that said effectively you can't invoke the suspect exception with respect to search warrants to go after a reporter if really what you're trying to do is investigate or prosecute somebody else. And the revised guidelines contain that sole purpose exception as well. So that really is the roadmap for an end run, is saying that, well, you asked the source for the information, the source committed a crime by getting the information, and therefore you're complicit.
Right. All right. So I want to think that example through because it seems to me a complicated example. If the Justice Department were ever to do that, you would be out here saying, wait a minute, why did they create this policy in the first place if only to circumvent it like this? It seems to me they wouldn't have much of a leg to stand on in answering that question, right?
Well, and this is the point that we make, right? That even if there's some uncertainty, you know, in the policy, the fact that it does include that the forbearance, as you note, for the receipt, possession, or publication of classified information and government information at large, that's relatively clear. The uncertainty is going to put these questions back where they always were, which is in the land of government press relations, you know, in politics and how the public responds to these types of stories.
So what has the reaction to the policy been? I mean, you guys were pretty enthusiastic about it. I assume the rest of the institutional press was as well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. With recognition that there are these questions that are still outstanding, the express parts of the policy are certainly quite strong.
And the policy, to the extent that nothing has arisen yet under it that we are aware of where it's been exercised one way or the other. Is that right?
So there is a case where Boston Globe in the I think it's the Varsity Blues cases in Massachusetts, there was a Boston Globe reporter who was subpoenaed, but to authenticate published information.
But that's an explicit exception.
Exactly.
But I mean, there hasn't been a case that anybody knows of in which under the previous policy, some process might have issued, but under the new policy, there has been no process, right?
Right. As far as I know, there's no process that is, I guess, triggered the close questions in the policy.
So there's no way at this stage to know how it's working or whether it's having a protective effect or whether the situation simply hasn't come up to test it yet.
I think that's fair, but the situation has not come up to test it yet. I mean, the other data point too is that I think during this point in the Trump administration, if I'm getting this right, you did have a demand that went to a reporter, the Allie Watkins case, and then you also had, you know, a series of leak investigations and prosecutions. We haven't had any of those.
So in light of that, do you think the Garland Justice Department has essentially decided to ease off on leak investigations in general? Or is this a situation where there are probably as many leak investigations as there ever were? They've just, you know, sworn off using reporters' records as evidence in them.
Without too much speculation, you know, if there are active leak investigations, then the policy has probably, and the policy itself says, right, that it doesn't limit the department's ability to pursue evidence in these cases from non-media sources. And, you know, and if you look at the leak prosecutions under both the Obama administration and the Trump administration, the cases where prosecutors have sought information from members of the news media are rare. You know, normally it is you seek it from the suspected leaker.
All right. So one problem with this policy from the news media's point of view is that, you know, you kind of live by the executive policy, you die by the executive policy. A new administration comes in, a new attorney general under this administration comes in, and you could have a completely different policy in this area. Just as you described the problem as an institutional friction, not a partisan thing, between the Justice Department and the press, to what extent is this an institutional solution, and to what extent is this a highly personal kind of Merrick Garland, Lisa Monaco solution that, you know, when you have, you know, Attorney General Rudy Giuliani or Attorney General Doug Jones or Attorney General, you know, Sally Yates may not be a lasting thing?
So that's a key point to make, and absolutely. And Attorney General Garland, you know, said that the department supports legislation to make the policy durable. Last Congress, there was some action on the Press Act, which is federal shield legislation. Senator Ron Wyden, who introduced the bill in the Senate, brought it to the floor and sought to pass on unanimous consent, but it was blocked by Senator Tom Cotton. That law would make certain features of this policy pretty durable. But that's absolutely of concern, that you could have it, that it is an internal policy. It's not subject to notice and comment. It can be changed at the discretion of a future administration or a future Justice Department. But that said, again, the dynamic over time has been perceived overreach or controversy over some overreach retrenchment by the department, apology, reform, and then rinse and repeat. And so there isn't a case where the policy has been weakened historically.
The guidelines have a bright line rule if you're engaged in news gathering. But if you're not engaged in news gathering, is there then a bright line rule that, you know, okay, Wittes, he's sometimes a reporter, but, you know, right now he looks like a bank robber. Let's get his records. I mean, is it sort of open season at that point, or are there some restrictions that apply even if, you know, hey, he may be a Washington Post reporter, but he seems to be, you know, running a heroin ring.
Right. And I think that's also – so in addition to the question of what's within the scope of news gathering and that sort of solicitation question that's hanging out there, there's also going to be this exception where you're not acting within the scope of news gathering. But even there, the policy provides that notice can be given to the subject. So even if you're – and the way that it phrases it is if you are not acting within the scope of news gathering, you're the subject or target of an investigation – and you're suspected of having committed an offense, even there, there's permissive notice. And if notice isn't given, then the deputy attorney general needs to be notified that process was issued. And then there's a few other things that kick in. And that's actually different from the previous policies where you would have been wholesale excluded from its coverage. So even there, you would have higher level eyes being put on the situation.
So all in all, having now had 6 months to think about this new policy, you guys are the reporters committee. Give it a letter grade. You sound pretty enthusiastic about it.
Absolutely. I mean, and we've said that where the policy is explicit on its coverage, it's historic, right? This is a situation where courts have said, you can do this. And the Department of Justice is saying, we won't do this. It's a big deal. But again, as practitioners, we need to live with the fact that there is some uncertainty, and we'll have to see how that plays out. But in terms of the new protections that are in the policy, A.
I would be remiss, since this is Lawfare, if I didn't say, hey, one thing this is going to do is it's going to frustrate a lot of FBI leak investigators, and you're going to have a situation where out of solicitude for the press, a whole lot of merited cases are not going to be brought because the Justice Department doesn't want to do things that are concededly legal for it to do and which the Supreme Court has blessed. And so to the disgruntled FBI agent who says, okay, that's really nice for the Washington Post reporter who's helping people commit crimes by giving them information that they shouldn't have. But what about the public who wants that classified information protected? What do you say to that person?
So this goes to, I think, the point that we were talking about earlier, which is that both sides have a job to do, and either side may have a different impression of what that job entails. I guess one thing I would say is for that agent or for the prosecutor I would expect, and I hope that they understand this. One of the concerns when it comes to aggressive leak investigations, particularly when you're talking about getting records from reporters, is that it's not just about the big dump of clearly classified material. The dynamic that is of greater concern, I think, is that you have sources that won't talk even close to the edges of those issues. They won't even touch something that, regardless of whether it's classified, even if it relates in potentially some way to the national defense, you have sources who just dry up there. And that's not a good situation for anybody, particularly when you're talking about a world in which the proliferation of digital fingerprints makes it, you know, as we've seen in these leak investigations, makes it where you can try and get the information from the suspected leaker first.
We're going to leave it there. Gabe Rotman, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks very much. Really great to be here. Thanks.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is the intrepid Kara Schillen of Goat Rodeo. You are our publicity department. And if you have not tweeted about the Lawfare podcast, if you have not shared the Lawfare podcast on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Pinterest, then you have not done your duty and you need to do that. You should also become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. The Lawfare podcast is edited by the one, the only Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.